I am your host, the Doc Chad Matthews, lordsofpain.net. Wherever you may be listening, Doc says.
This is just what the doc ordered. I'm saying welcome. They sick of the other shows. Chad here to help them. The author of the mania era is bringing terror on. This is the preparer for the knowledge that he about to showcase. Like a bar that you lift, his opinions hold weight. He wrote a few books and he's working on another for y'all. This a 5-star podcast, Chad, let's get it on.
Author of the WrestleMania era, the book of sports entertainment and of the doctor's orders on lordsofpain.net. Hello and welcome to The Doc Says here on the Chair Shot Radio Network. I am your host, the Doc Chad Matthews, author of the WrestleMania era book series and longtime writer of the column The Doctor's Orders on lordsofpain.net. And from wherever you may be listening, I thank you for making me a part of your day. There are going to be a couple of primary topics tackled on today's show. The first being the next installment of the WWE Decade in Review series, which has genuinely been a great reflection on my personal history with that company. And then I'm going to segue into comparing AEW Dynamite through its first 2 months to the SmackDown brand that I've championed as the best stretch of WWE TV in this current era, following a general comparison I made between the two on Twitter a couple of weeks ago. And that SmackDown brand I'm speaking of is the one that began in 2016 after Brand Split 2.0 began. So let's begin this show today really with 2016, which to me is the last year of my WWE fandom as I'd known it for so long. I've tried to come up with themes for each of the years I've covered to date. And for this one, I'd like to say the theme was the fork in the road. They approached a fork in the road in 2016. They could have WWE leaned into the era on the rise hard. And I think if they had, we'd be looking at a very different WWE right now. And as a byproduct, a very different pro wrestling world altogether. Or they could lean into what I began labeling that year as the part-timer problem, among other habitual issues. The reality is that they didn't make a decision fully in 2016, leaning at times both ways before fully turning down the problematic road, leading us to where we now sit today, looking at a company, in my opinion, virtually unrecognizable to its storied past in certain key ways. But it's important to point out throughout this podcast that it was still very much a WWE in 2016, with its compass pointed in the right direction. Look at AJ Styles, the unquestionable most valuable wrestler of 2016. A soft few months working with a Chris Jericho who hadn't accepted his own limitations physically yet were quickly made a distant memory when he squared off with Roman Reigns for a pair of exceptional matches, one of which, at Extreme Rules, was a top five match of the year candidate. His run with John Cena followed, a feud that stands currently as the only one of his WWE rivalries thus far worthy of a chapter in my book about the greatest matches and rivalries. A chapter pretty deep into that book, mind you, considering that it produced a top 10 to 15 all-time SummerSlam match and a top 10 all-time Royal Rumble match. Then came his outstanding run with Dean Ambrose, which itself produced top 10 worthy match of the year candidates. All in all, Styles was a revelation and yet another example of the kind of change in recruitment strategy spearheaded by the pioneers earlier in the decade who made it the norm to find the best talent in the world beyond WWE sports entertainment empire, rather than constantly throwing meatheads from the gym at the wall, hoping that one or a few of them might become the next John Cena or Batista, an exercise that produced but one Cena and one Batista, but that produced about 100 versions of Chris Masters. Styles made WWE better, and particularly, as a character, was made better by WWE's platform. Few stars in this half decade were given the chance to maximize what their careers could be in WWE, but he was one of them. And it started with his virtually unanimous MVP run in 2016. Contrast AJ Styles that year with Shane McMahon, whose return caused, admittedly, one of the biggest pops I've ever heard on Raw in early 2016, but whose presence quickly offered an insufferable example of WWE's obsession with returning to its past at the expense of concentrating on its present and future. Presented with a golden opportunity to elevate a young talent at WrestleMania 32 opposite Undertaker, whose long-awaited match with John Cena was canceled because the once cyborg Cena finally suffered an untimely Mania time injury, WWE instead turned to Shane. I went to WrestleMania 32 in Dallas, and I will tell you right now, hand to heart, that my buzz for that event was killed dead, practically, by Shane versus Undertaker. I mean, I tried, and I didn't really want to admit it back then. I was in a really good place with WWE back then, so I talked myself into being pumped up about it. But when that event birthed the modern trend of obnoxiously long Big Four pay-per-views and stunk the joint out once the women's triple threat had stolen the show before Hour 3 was over, I immediately thought back to Shane versus Taker being the choice. I thought it was the grossest example yet of the past star trend. You get it when it's Rock. It's The Rock. You get it when it's Brock, as much as I've come to dislike Brock. You get it when it's Taker or Triple H or Jericho. Everyone just mentioned is an all-time top 15 of the Mania era selection. You make exceptions for them, even if you don't agree with the principle of the thing and how often that principle is utilized. You don't make that exception for Shane McMahon. Two of the contemporary generation's top young guns were ready and willing to take on the dead man that year and make something out of the opportunity and give Undertaker a match to be remembered. That being Dean Ambrose and Kevin Owens, the former undoubtedly the hottest act in the game by Shane's February comeback, and the latter a wrecking ball heel that was just 8 months removed from pinning John Cena clean in his WWE debut match. Both went on to top five MVP caliber years in 2016. Now, my pick to face Taker at WrestleMania would have been Ambrose. You keep Brock versus Bray Wyatt as originally planned or whatever, then it's a done deal. Shane could have guest refereed the exhausting main event of WrestleMania 32 between Reigns and Hunter instead. WrestleMania 32, folks, was my personal first step away from WWE toward the fan I am of theirs now. Somewhat saddened by a relationship perhaps but probably not, irreparably damaged. Never say never. Styles was so good, though, in the months that followed Mania 32, that in that moment, I quickly looked on the bright side. Seth Rollins coming back for what I maintain is one of the best matches of this generation opposite Roman Reigns at Money in the Bank, and my formula's pick for the WWE Match of the Year in 2016 certainly helped as well, as did the Owens versus Sami Zayn rivalry that ran for much of the first 6 months of the year and peaked at the July pay-per-view Battleground with one of the top 10 match of the year candidates as well. KO was another big reason for my overall optimism. He and Ambrose had a top 10 match of the year candidate at Royal Rumble in the midst of their early IC title renaissance that Owens first stimulated. Then there was the feud with Zayn, eventually won the Universal title. It was a hell of a year, too, to accomplish some of the things that he did, one that I feel put him in that rare position to be a cornerstone star for the company in a modern era that actually has a chance to accomplish some of the things on par with some of his legendary peers like Edge and Mick Foley and other enormously successful secondary top guys in the all-time discussion. KO versus Zayn at Battleground was the subtraction of a botched moonsault away from ranking as one of the quintessential non-title mid-card achievements in WWE history. And even with the flubbed line, so to speak, still rates very highly among the peers of its genre in modern WWE lore. Of course, some of what influenced their story to feel so engaging was what happened between them and NXT the year prior. NXT, which asserted itself as loudly as ever in 2016, and began this very interesting sidebar conversation that year about how we're supposed to discuss the black and yellow in relation to wider WWE history. Zane made that conversation a little louder over Mania 32 weekend with his stunning match against the debuting Shinsuke Nakamura, and people held their match was the best of the year throughout 2016. Now, I never agreed with that, but I would later contend that the NXT performance that did push for the top overall spot on the Match of the Year countdown was the Revival versus DIY 2 out of 3 Falls match in Toronto. That, to me, the best no ladders, no tables tag team match I've ever seen. I'll tell you in hindsight. NXT announced itself in 2014. What the women accomplished in 2015 was too impressive to ignore when discussing and doing like an analysis, as I was doing at that time, like naming wrestlers and matches of the month in WWE overall, and including NXT in those discussions. They eventually made me consider their story, that being the women, that eventually sort of moved into WWE proper when they got there as one of the defining WrestleMania-era stories, just the women's revolution. But that tag team division, also including American Alpha in 2016, added a layer that made clear NXT was here to stay in these conversations. The knock-on effect, though, was that it showed us what WWE could be when they mixed the amazing athleticism and the top-notch production value. It showed us pro wrestling at a top-flight level evolved and created within many of us a desire to see that happening on the biggest stages possible, not just on occasion and on smaller stages, but in the spots on the cards of the year that would help those matches become this generation's Brett versus Owen, or HBK versus Taker, or Rock versus Triple H. It was competition for the main brand under the main brand's own larger umbrella. And it was weird, wasn't it, that it achieved that status? I mean, we were asked to let Shane's ridiculous punches get 40 minutes at WrestleMania, a whole bunch of standing around for setting up his three spots. 40 freaking minutes while Shinsuke strikes and his remaining prime athletic year in wrestling were relegated to a lesser stage. And because of all that, some of us wondered, wouldn't it be nice if that wasn't the case? I mean, Shane's own kids sat in that Dallas crowd, fervently chanting for the NXT product. The brand split was obviously one of the defining stories of WWE as well. 2016, man, interesting year. I was miffed about the brand split at first, thinking of all the benefits that WWE had gained from eliminating that concept a few years prior. The original brand split, it kind of died a slow death, in my opinion. Resurrecting it and bringing back the swarm of championships that watered down each division in its original iteration was not something I favored, but I did give it an honest chance. I was at a very good place in my WWE fandom and was more than willing to give it a shot. It's hard not to look back on that early period without accounting for 2017's reshuffle and beyond to present day. But I readily admit to feeling great about Brand Split 2.0 by 2016's end, with the exception of it being the catalyst for the biggest disappointment of this entire decade for me. That being the Shield triple threat that should have main-evented WrestleMania, with the one being the champ, one being Mr. Money in the Bank, and one being the Rumble winner, and instead what it became, which was a lukewarm, rushed affair, almost presented as background fodder for the stupid Raw SmackDown GM crap and all the split-related nonsense. The brand split concept has a lot of conceptual advantages that I feel that WWE did a good job capitalizing on early on in the 2.0 era. It affords a lot more talent, a lot more opportunity, for one. And by mid-2016, WWE had amassed the most talented collection of in-ring performers, not to be confused with sports entertainers, if you will, who readily excel as characters, that they'd had since the WWE-WCW merger. The brand split gave breathing room to the women's division and allowed Banks versus Charlotte to hit its stride and become the record-breaking feud that produced the TV match of the year on the first Raw of the post-draft and one of the 10 best matches of the year in their groundbreaking Hell in a Cell main event. Seriously, if you loved Banks versus Lynch this year, I'm not sure why you wouldn't love Banks versus Flair that year. And basically dropped the R, that whole situation with Banks and Charlotte, pretty much dropped the R in Revolution to stamp the women's movement as a full-on evolution. The brand split allowed wrestlers previously from the lost generation of misfit headliners, usurped by hungrier go-getters like the Shield members, Bray Wyatt and Kevin Owens circa 2013, 14, and 15, to start career renaissances that have reshaped how we'll remember their careers, looking at Ziggler and The Miz specifically there. The brand split allowed both Owens and Styles to optimize their runs toward WWE MVP candidacy, leaving WWE's pick for the top star of the company, Roman Reigns, to wallow in creative ineptitude and missed opportunities to take firmer command of the throne. The brand split allowed Finn Balor to essentially make his mark in the wider industry as the first Universal Champion, probably the biggest thing he'll ever do in the business if we're being honest about wider pro wrestling perception with respect to his Bullet Club founding achievement. Only later would the weaknesses of the split return to focus, but frankly that's a topic for 2017's breakdown. Honestly, if you go back to this podcast peak, when I was passionately doing Raw versus SmackDown competitive breakdowns and bringing on my pals Rich Latta and Dave Fenichel for Raw and SmackDown only pay-per-view reviews and things of that nature, I think you'd find me about as pumped up about being a WWE fan in that moment as I'd ever been at that point, with no real end in sight. NXT was thriving, and former NXT stars were thriving on the main roster. Raw was acquitting itself well with KO at the helm. SmackDown was becoming the house that AJ Styles built. And I entered 2017 with truly great enthusiasm. Now, before we move into topic number two for today, I want to give a quick shout out to the Cruiserweight Classic, which is by far the best tournament that WWE has produced in 20 years, and that I much, much prefer to the women's tournaments. Now, let's take a quick look at the snapshot of WWE's best in 2016. Match of the Year 2016. Nakamura vs. Zayn, number 10. The Raw vs. SmackDown Men's Survivor Series Elimination Match, number 9. Styles vs. Ambrose at TLC and Backlash, tied for number 8. Miz vs. Ziggler at No Mercy, number 7. Zayn vs. Owens at Battleground, number 6. Banks vs. Flair at Hell in a Cell, number 5. Styles vs. Cena at SummerSlam, number 4. Reigns vs. Styles at Extreme Rules, number 3. Revival vs. DIY in Toronto, number 2, and Reigns vs. Rollins at Money in the Bank, number 1. That's a match I'm actually going to discuss on my buddy Samuel Plan's podcast, Sports Entertainment is Dead. We're going to profile that match as one of the couple of matches in WWE history that should have main evented WrestleMania, and that could have, presentation exactly as is, been put in that main event Mania spotlight and thrived as an all-time classic. But that's a topic for that podcast. The most underrated matches of 2016, in no particular order. Ambrose versus Owens at Royal Rumble. It's historically underrated because it was fantastic. Ziggler versus The Miz at Backlash and TLC, which, while not carrying the historical weight of their match at No Mercy, all three of them were all fantastic. Balor versus Reigns on Finn's debut night on Raw, and Rollins versus Owens at Hell in a Cell. The best mid-card matches of 2016, in no particular order. The four-way at Extreme Rules for the Intercontinental title, featuring Miz, Cesaro, Zayn, and Owens. All the Ziggler and Miz matches. Zayn versus Owens, of course. Cesaro versus Sheamus match 7, in the best of 7. Most underrated wrestler of 2016, to me, was Becky Lynch, who started the year by working her way into the title scene at WrestleMania thanks to her excellent output opposite Charlotte, particularly as a character, but who'd never really seemed to gain full trust from a company seemingly resistant to get behind her as a star it could put in the spotlight without flanking her with multiple perceived-to-be-bigger female personalities. I'd also like to nominate Sami Zayn here because his production was stellar even beyond the Owens feud. Perennial most underrated candidate Cesaro had a very impressive 8 months, by the way, consistently popping up in really good matches as usual. So, switching gears here, I made a comparison on Twitter last week of AEW Dynamite to SmackDown right after Brand Split 2.0 began, and before the shakeup that featured Jinder Mahal becoming champion. Longtime followers of this show know how much I enjoyed that period of SmackDown history, led by AJ Styles and Dean Ambrose, and The Miz and Dolph Ziggler, and complimented by John Cena during his last meaningful stretch of work in WWE, and the emergent new character versions of the Usos, plus a hungry women's division eager to prove itself in whatever capacity afforded it. That was my favorite stretch of WWE television since the SmackDown shows after the draft lottery in 2009. I was also very fond of the WWE Raw run from the summer of 2013 until Survivor Series 2014, but I'll come back to that. One of the things that I loved about that SmackDown run, and I guess I should preface quickly for the sake of consistency, that I have said indeed that the WWE's best stretch of TV this decade was from the push for SummerSlam 2013 until the last episode of Raw before Survivor Series 2014. But I enjoyed the SmackDown 16-17 run more, enjoyed, because the Daniel Bryan saga obviously had its emotional hooks in me back in 13-14, and it wasn't until I could benefit from hindsight that I came to fully appreciate that period, whereas SmackDown was just pure fun. Would I take the trade-off of a greater emotional payoff? Of course, but that's a topic for another day that might come into play a little bit later here when focus shifts to AEW. I digress. What I loved about the SmackDown run echoes a lot of what I mentioned earlier in the fall, when breaking down what constitutes good wrestling TV. I thought SmackDown in 16-17 flowed incredibly well. The roster positioning was clear. There was a very clear focus on championships and championship contenders, and it rarely seemed like writers of the show were spinning a roulette wheel to come up with what was coming up next. The roster itself seemed to have a lot of chemistry, which at the time, good friend of the pod Rich Ladd and I compared to a basketball team constructed with team-oriented goals and a group that collectively bought into them. When they rebooted the rosters post-Mania 33, that chemistry fell apart, with the roster positioning getting inverted with a jobber champion. So, bringing AEW Dynamite into focus, one of its greatest strengths to date is that it feels like it has direction and planning behind its shows each week. One of the constant knocks on WWE TV is that it feels rewritten at the last minute, which certainly borrows from a long-held and often confirmed Vince McMahon-based rumor that he rewrites constantly, and often up until minutes of showtime, rather than mapping a plan not built from concrete, but from a pliable material that can be changed if something isn't working. AEW feels like a show with a plan, and it flows week to week quite well so far. There is an inherent goal for the roster to excel within the framework of a larger team goal of being successful enough to keep their run on TNT going, and to eventually become more and more competitive in the industry at large. And I feel like that permeates through to the entire product right now. The hot crowds echo a passion that emanates from the wrestlers and the announcers on down to Justin Roberts and the referees. I felt that live. You feel like you're a part of a revolution when you watch AEW. SmackDown has always been the B show until its massive TV deal with Fox somewhat altered perception a bit recently. But in 16-17, it was dealing with the usual perception of getting slighted in the draft during the brand split era. But their roster back then parlayed that underdog-type dynamic into a hungry group of really talented people. That sound familiar? Basically, I feel like AEW has just taken that wonderful formula that SmackDown had in 16-17 and improved on it. It's like the run-and-gun 7 seconds or less Phoenix Suns led by Steve Nash. And then the Warriors here more recently, led by Steph Curry. It's just, it's an improved version of what was already a template. AEW has a foundational advantage with Chris Jericho anchoring the show. He's a top 10 all-time WrestleMania era caliber guy who is reinventing himself. SmackDown back then, they didn't have that. Although AJ Styles certainly elevated himself quickly up the all-time ladder in short order in his very first year in WWE by way of his reinvention. Actually, you could probably call that a wash because Jericho might be twice what Styles was on the microphone, not to discredit what AJ did because it was damn impressive back then. But Styles was in the midst of an all-time run in the ring that modern Jericho can't match. Nevertheless, since we're talking TV, a platform better built for main event talent selling us on why we should watch them attempt to knock it out of the park on pay-per-view, or a special event, then the character advantage possessed by Jericho gives AEW the nod. Flanking AEW's Le Champion is an impressive cast of headlining caliber talent, namely Cody, Kenny Omega, Pac, and Jon Moxley, who is the tie that binds these two brands in question, as he was the primary flanker of AJ when he was Dean Ambrose, joined by part-time John Cena, Randy Orton and Bray Wyatt, plus a resurgent Miz and Dolph Ziggler who were competing over the IC title, but who were huge pieces of the puzzle to that SmackDown era's success. The comparison there is really interesting, because I think history may seriously end up underrating the Ziggler-Miz feud, and that's kind of why I like doing podcasts like these, because someone has to stand up and remind people that Miz versus Ziggler was the best intercontinental title feud of the last 20 years. Neither of those guys is getting the all-time level love that most participants in all-time great IC title feuds usually get. They aren't Triple H and The Rock. They're not Mr. Perfect and Bret Hart. And they're not HBK and Razor Ramon. I'd be shocked if we're sitting here 10 years from now talking about Miz versus Ziggler like we're talking about Rock versus Triple H from 1998, late last decade. Shocked. But that's the reality, though. AEW doesn't have a feud like that under its belt yet. And that's a significant plus in the SmackDown column, in the SmackDown being better category. But I'll be honest in saying that I think it's the only spot in which SmackDown from that era was better than AEW Dynamite is right now. You could make an argument for the SmackDown women's division at that time being better than AEW's, because that's certainly the biggest knock on AEW. SmackDown's division back then had Becky, who deserved, from her early 2016 run with Flair and Banks, a shot at carrying the title. But that era's women's division isn't going to be remembered for her. It's going to be remembered instead, I think, for the rise of Alexa Bliss, and perhaps even for the really good work that Divas era holdovers like Nikki Bella and Natty put in. AEW's women's division really isn't much right now. It's the least fleshed out part of their program, and as such, I mean, that's been pretty well documented, but it's just not got enough star power to bring forth much of an expectation. Yet I continually feel like they come out there and make the most of their time on camera, just like I felt in that tag team match this year introducing Statlander, or whatever her name is, along with some of the more recent up-and-comers in AEW's division. The SmackDown group's strength was also in establishing itself and creating rather than exceeding an expectation. But I think Becky's run, like AEW's women's run thus far overall, was considered a bit underwhelming. And so to me, looking back at it, that's kind of a wash. A level-headed person could review the preceding dialogue and call it pretty even, all things considered. SmackDown then, like AEW now, wasn't lighting the world on fire with super engaging material for their stars, but they were simply presenting a good wrestling show that progressed nicely from week to week and month to month. I think where AEW has a giant advantage is the strength of its tag team division, an absence of silliness in places where you'd rather have more seriousness. I'm looking at James Ellsworth there. James Ellsworth was over, and that matters, because things that get over should get pushed. But just because something is over doesn't mean it has to be pushed all the way to the top. Ellsworth was very prominently featured, consistently, for several months. Imagine if AEW put Marco Stunt as a heavily featured part of the Jericho-Cody feud. Ellsworth was out of place, pushed to a level where his value decreased what he was involved in. Stunt is in a nice, cushy mid-card spot, flanked by two more serious acts. Not serious in terms of the gimmick, because their gimmick is inherently silly, but serious in the sense that you can buy Jungle Boy as a threat, and you absolutely have to take Luchasaurus seriously with the way that he's presented. I think one of the things that frustrates diehard fans about WWE is that even in a great era of really strong, consistent television like SmackDown in 2016-17, you're forced to take the good with a pretty steady dose of meh, or worse. Comedy has its place in pro wrestling. It's been proven over and over again that it helps the variety show dynamic of it. But when you look at Ellsworth and his spot, or if you look at Heath Slater winning the tag titles with Rhino, these things happened at the expense of what could have been a generational tag team rivalry in the Usos versus American Alpha, and at the expense of Ambrose versus Styles being a rivalry that people could look back on in a decade thinking about how complete it was, both in the ring and in terms of character clashes on television via segments and promos. It's a conscious choice, but when WWE has been at its best and booming not just financially but creatively, comedy was left to comedy segments, and the titles and main event scene was held in a higher regard. Comedy can be used by headliners, and it can be used in championship situations, but the timing has to be right. We'll see if AEW eventually gets that aspect right. For instance, is Kenny Omega failing to bench 90 pounds after cutting a potentially character-resetting promo an example of getting that right? I don't know. I really don't. But I know that that promo was 85% of that segment, and the bench press thing was just a tiny piece of it that sat in the background. Even if you look at the absence of a space for women in WWE to grow beyond the title scene, necessitating that someone like Alexa Bliss at the time of her ascendance in 2016 really had to be pushed to the title to validate her by WWE logic, because otherwise she would have fizzled out after the Lynch feud and had nowhere to go, that's another example of accepting the good with the bad. Truly, what AEW has done to date isn't giving me much reason to complain, and I don't feel like, at this point, I'm being asked to accept the good with the bad. The AEW women's division, if we're judging by what they've compiled in their headlining space, and their tag division, and their stars right underneath the headlining space, where guys like MJF, Adam Page, Darby Allin, Jimmy Havoc even, and a cast of characters in the tag team scene that could conceivably be elevated at almost a moment's notice reside, I think the women's division's going to be just fine. It just might take some time. I don't get the sense that they're tone deaf about it, or feel like the social media vibe about it is irrelevant because they're so much smarter and wiser than we are, which is the vibe you get from WWE. It'll come with that division. And in the meantime, there's so much to like about what AEW is doing. I think a leg up AEW has on just about all the competition right now is the win-loss record thing and the rankings, which I personally love thus far. For years, I championed that concept in column form, hoping WWE would see the value in it. The thing about it is, it's not like it has to be front and center in a huge part of the product, but the fact that the announcers can talk about it and it give context to a match this week or next month is a small thing that has a big impact. Instead of a match being between two random wrestlers on a night, then you've got two wrestlers fight to move up the food chain in a subtle but still overt way. Rather than having, say, Wyatt versus Ziggler in 2016 be a match that one might assume leads to a title shot a few months down the road, having the win-loss records and the rankings factoring in, even in the background, makes something like Pac versus Adam Page meaningful without even having to shove it down our throats that it's meaningful. You can see their rankings and their records and assume that Pac winning would maintain his status while Page winning would elevate his status. There's so much inherent drama to that, as evidenced by American sports particularly. One thing AEW hasn't done yet is find that feud that really connects to people on a visceral level. That us versus them feel is inherent to their product because they have risen on account of their needing to be more viable alternatives to WWE. But WWE itself proved at its creative best this decade when striking that chord with CM Punk versus John Cena and Daniel Bryan versus the Authority, or more recently the Kofi Mania movement. And that was something that people felt back in the day with Austin versus McMahon, that they were able to find WWE was at its creative peak this decade, a really visceral dynamic. I think if AEW can figure out how to capture some of that magic, even if it's in a unique way, remembering that we didn't really know what it felt like to respond to CM Punk and his message until he was speaking it loudly and clearly at the end of that Monday Night Raw in June 2011, then AEW can take a step in the direction of galvanizing a greater number of wrestling fans. I'll take the smooth quality and things that AEW does well over anything I've seen in WWE since the SmackDown 6 reboot in 2009 that featured Jericho, Mysterio, Edge, Jeff Hardy, CM Punk, John Morrison, etc. But if they can add that visceral dynamic, then dude, watch out. It may be a while because those things just happen naturally, and they often happen because something about a product is missing. Raw needed to be edgier. Enter Austin. After WCW needed to be edgier and entered the New World Order. Raw needed to be more organic and embracing of the 21st century wrestler. Enter CM Punk. I'm not sure what AEW is going to stumble upon. We'll see. Perhaps the best historical comp for them might end up being the SmackDown 6 era of the blue brand in WWE back in 2002. Maybe that would make for an interesting comparison for a different day. But nevertheless, that is it for today's show, ladies and gentlemen, and I appreciate you joining me. I would love to get your thoughts on social media about my comments regarding WWE in 2016 and about my comparison drawn between SmackDown in 16-17 to AEW Dynamite as we've known it through these first couple of months. I appreciate you joining me. Have a great rest of your weekend. Hit me up at the Doc LOP on Twitter for any comments about the content of today's show, and I'll be back next week to talk about all sorts of different wrestling topics. We'll see what happens. Thanks. Take care.
This is just what the doc ordered. I'm saying welcome. They sick of the other shows. Chad here to help them. The author of the Mania era is bringing terror on radio. This is the preparer for the knowledge that he about to showcase. Like a bar that you lift, his opinions hold weight. He wrote a few books and he's working on another for y'all. This a 5-star podcast. Chad, let's get it on.
Author of the WrestleMania era.